BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Claire McDonnell and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast.
Hello and welcome to a brand new week on Woman's Hour, and it could end up being a pretty momentous one for women in politics. America could get its first ever female president, and here in the UK, in the last week, we've already ticked off a few firsts. The first female chancellor delivering a budget, and the first black woman to lead a major political party in the UK, Kemi Badenoch, is now the new leader of the Conservative Party. In an interview yesterday with the BBC, she played that down. But does it feel like a pivotal moment for women in UK politics to you? Should these firsts for women be celebrated? Or do you think, as Kemi Badenoch says, we shouldn't focus on them? Is it an exciting new dawn, ushering in meaningful change, or just distant changes in high office that won't impact your life? You can text the programme. Love to hear from you. The number is 84844. Texts will be charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we are at BBC Woman's Hour, and you can email us through our website, or you can send us a WhatsApp message or voice note using this number, 03700 100444. Plus, the fastest woman on the planet, current Olympic 100-metre gold medalist Julian Alfred, joins me in the studio. We'll talk dark comic horror and gender politics with author Eliza Clark, named in the Forbes 30 Under 30 list about her new collection of short stories. And the film director who went to Antarctica to chronicle the search for Ernest Shackleton's endurance ship. Spoiler, they found it. Natalie Hewitt is going to be joining me live in the Woman's Hour studio. Great lineup of guests for you this morning. But first, let's start with politics, because on Saturday, Kemi Badenoch became the new leader of the Conservative Party. She beat Robert Jenrick to become the fourth woman and the first black woman to lead a major political party here in the UK. However, as she told Laura Kunzberg yesterday, she doesn't want to dwell on this.
I think that the best thing will be when we get to a point where the colour of your skin is no more remarkable than the colour of your eyes or the colour of your hair. We live in a multiracial country, and that is great, but we have to work very hard to make sure that it doesn't become something divisive, where people see themselves as being part of groups rather than all being British. So when I hear people say, isn't this remarkable, we have a black female leader of the Conservative Party, I'm glad, because it shows that my country and my party are actually places where it doesn't matter who you are, what you look like. Mm. It's about what the offer is. What I don't want is for that to be the thing that ends up being talked about.
Kemi Badenoch, she is, as we speak, assembling her front bench. One appointment already made, Rebecca Harris as chief whip. Of course, if we hear any other news on who she has appointed as we're on air here on Woman's Hour, we'll bring it to you. She became an MP in 2017 after a career in banking and IT, and has also said she would offer jobs to all of her colleagues who launched leadership bids in July as well. So let's find out a little bit more about her and what she might mean for women inside and outside of the party. I'm joined first by Katie Balls, political editor of The Spectator. Morning, Katie.
Morning.
It was a narrow victory for Kemi Badenoch, wasn't it? Can you just talk us through that?
Yes, she won just over 50%, 56% of the vote. And I think when you look at that, that's close to the 2022 Tory leadership contest between Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. It's a little bit less in terms of her lead over Robert Jenrick. So it's fairly narrow as things go. But given her team are quite nervous, I think on the final week that Robert Jenrick might be further ahead, there was some relief when the result came through.
And as we heard in that clip there, she's keen not to dwell on the first aspect of this win. She's painting herself as somebody who's bringing people together, wanting it to be all about inclusivity. Does that stack up with her?
Well, I think, as you say, she is quite allergic to identity politics, and therefore you see Rachel Reeves, who wants to often talk about her achievement of being the first female chancellor. Kemi Badenoch does not want to talk about being a woman leader. She doesn't really want to talk about being the first black female leader of a major political party in the UK, and instead thinks progress is almost like not being observed. I think some in her party would actually like her to play more on it, because the Tory party loves putting on tote bags and things, all these achievements of female leaders, and saying to Labour, you haven't managed to do it. When it comes to her general approach on equality and so forth, I mean, she's had the equalities brief when it comes to gender. I think that she is someone who's talked a lot about integration, but obviously views will differ on the best way to go about that.
Yeah, let's just talk about that, because, as you say, not a fan of identity politics, very outspoken on what she does believe in, including single-sex spaces. So tell us what she said on that.
Well, she's been very pro single-sex spaces. She's praised J.K. Rowling, who, of course, is seen as a champion when it comes to speaking up for women and gender-born women. And I think that if you think about also the gender recognition law that the SNP government tried to pass, it was Kemi Badenoch, when she was in the cabinet, who was one of the key voices in persuading Rishi Sunak to do what had never been done before and have a Westminster government bringing in a section order to try and oppose it, and to stop the SNP government changing the law. And the UK government was successful in this. And I think it shows that it's an area where you can expect her to talk a lot, but also do a lot, perhaps a hardening of the current position. And I think some in the Tory party think that she says the right things on this, but they don't want this to be the most dominating part of her leadership. And they want her to be talking about other issues too, such as, you know, the economy, business and things, rather than the depictions she sometimes gets as a bit of an anti-woke warrior.
And she doesn't seem to want any kind of exceptionalism put her way, because the fact that she's a mother to three young children, because it was brought up, wasn't it, during the election campaign, that maybe she wouldn't have as much time to devote to being leader because she has a very young family. How did she deal with that?
I don't think she was particularly impressed by the comments by one of the fellow MPs, and her camp too, I think, were quite critical, saying, you know, Robert Jenrick also has children. Why is it the case that's coming up for her? But I think also you looked very early on in the campaign when she went on holiday, and she was heavily criticised by some camps for taking a summer holiday. And in quite Kemi Badenoch style, she took to social media. I think rapid rebuttal online could be a defining feature of her leadership, and said, you're all criticising me. I promise my children I'm going on holiday, and I'm taking them on holiday, and that's what I'm going to call balance, and we should really cut politicians a bit of a break. So I think she's going to be trying to argue for some balance when it comes to what we expect from our front bench politicians.
She has a foot in the real world, doesn't she? She came to politics around 2017 in that election. What is her background then, and how might it inform how she leads the party and how she leads the opposition of this country?
So she spent her early years in Nigeria, and she's described that as quite a middle class upbringing. But one of the comments that got her quite a lot of criticism is she said then she came to the UK, and that was when she discovered what it's like to be working class, because she was working in McDonald's. She was trying to make ends meet, and she went to university, undergrad, then a different course, and became an engineer. You often hear Kemi Badenoch saying, I am an engineer, to suggest she is logical. She had a career in finance, engineer side of things. And then briefly a spell at The Spectator, where I, of course, worked, but that was not in the editorial department, and entered Parliament in 2017, not expecting to get the seat. She was not the favourite. She beat a Theresa May favourite for selection. And then from that, because it was such a small cohort of Tory MPs, because it was a bit of a disaster, that election for the Tories, Theresa May lost the majority. It meant that you have a very tight-knit group, but also she got a lot of attention because she was very quickly seen as the rising star, which I think she probably, and has said, she found a bit of a curse in a way, because you can't make mistakes quietly. Everyone is looking at what you do.
How does she then, she only has 120 Conservative MPs, and this has been something that's been spoken about over the weekend, that if she's going to have to, in a way, be this inclusive character, because there's so many jobs that people need to do, that if she becomes this, or she carries on down the divisive route, will she have enough Tory MPs, backbench MPs, to actually function as a working opposition?
Yeah, I mean, everyone will really say in the Tory party, Kemi Badenoch is a fighter. But depending on who is saying it, it's either a compliment or an insult. And it can be seen as one of her big strengths, but it can also be seen as the reason she is abrasive to some colleagues, and some colleagues just did not get behind her. And therefore, she's going to have to pick the right fights and who to have fights with. And I think there's a real hope in parts of the party that Kemi Badenoch is going to really try and fight Keir Starmer and Nigel Farage, and not so much being dismissive of colleagues, because one of the first challenges is the shadow cabinet. We already know that James Cleverly, who was knocked out before the final stage, said he's not going to serve in the shadow cabinet. If she can't get Tom Tugendhat, another leadership candidate, Robert Jenrick, Priti Patel, Mel Stride to serve, it's going to start to look like a bit of a statement on her leadership. So she does need to build some bridges. There are plenty of jobs to go around with this many few MPs, but you need to have different parts of the party in key positions to show she can do that.
And we know how it panned out with the Conservative Party at the last election when they tried to out-reform reform. It didn't really go that well. She is to the right of the party. What do you think she's going to do? Stick to the same messages or claw back a bit of the centre ground?
I think what all these things will say is they'll try and do both. And the question is, how realistic is that? Henry Badenoch has not gone into specific policy. That was a big part of her leadership. She was under pressure to do it in her campaign. The other three final candidates in the final four did. And that means there's a bit of a question mark over her specific policies. And I think she's probably going to face some criticism for how slowly she plans to come up with policy formations. If anything, she's almost a bit of a vibes politician in the sense that she is authentic. And she hopes, I think her diagnosis is the party became too managerialist, and authenticity and straight talking will get some of those reform voters back. But also, you do have to remember, while she is to the right, she has stood up to the European Research Group of Brexiteers. She has told them before that she, you know, she's not an arsonist, she's a conservative. She wasn't going to take every idea from the hard Brexiteers, though she did vote for Brexit. So she will try and find a middle way, I think, through her attitude and presence combined with some pragmatism.
Katie, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to bring in Baroness Kate Fall, Conservative peer, and Ella Robertson-McKay here, former chair of Conservative Young Women. Welcome, both of you.
Good morning.
Morning, Claire.
Baroness Fall, let's start with you. What are you hoping for from Kemi Badenoch?
Well, look, I think people are hoping for a fresh start after a terrible general election and then a period of sort of blank where Rishi Sunak has done a good job being a caretaker leader. But Labour have made a start and not a particularly good one. And yet we haven't really heard a strong voice from the Conservatives because they've been sort of fighting yet another leadership election. I think in the eyes of the public, they've had rather too many of those. And I think in last week, you see the budget, which was a very sort of political, very ideological budget, in many ways, quite a sort of old-fashioned Labour budget. And although Rishi responded extremely well, it wasn't a fresh voice or a new voice or the new leader. So I think that actually Kemi starts on, that's a gift for Kemi, because she can come in straight away, take the fight to Labour, really establish what it is that the Tories would do differently and get going straight away rather than sort of looking back and having a fight on a sort of blame game. So I think it's a really good opportunity for her.
It certainly seems, Ella, that that's her modus operandi. She doesn't want to pick over the past. She wants to move forward. So what are you hoping she will do for younger women in particular?
Well, I think she's been very careful not to outline tons of policies in her leadership race, which is quite a risky strategy. So she's really dedicated to a period of reform for the party and for the party deciding together what it really stands for. It's been in power for a long time. It's had so many different leaders in quite quick succession. So I think even to the members, there's a bit of wishy-washiness about what it really means to be a member of the Conservative Party in 2024. And Kemi's been really clear that it's time to re-articulate that and not just come up with a lot of pop-up policies very quickly, which I think is the right thing to do, because I think it's going to be quite a long parliamentary term. And much like David Cameron did, he really reset the Conservative Party, spent time building up policies, spent time rebuilding trust with voters. I mean, I think it's very clear people were absolutely sick of the Tories this year. I think lots of people in constituencies who'd voted Tories their whole life voted Lib Dem or otherwise, or reform as a protest vote. And so she's really got to think very carefully about the Tories' offer to all demographics in society. I think what was really interesting about the Labour budget, I mean, Labour's had a very strong appeal to young people, but there was nothing for young people in that budget last week. Stamp duty back to where it was, much more expensive to buy a home if you're a young person. So where I think the Tory party has neglected young voters for a while, I think she's got an opportunity to come in with a good offer, as she does for pensioners, you know, winter fuel duty being scrapped. There's okay. lots of things that she could be prosecuting at the moment.
Yes, and I'm sure at the first Prime Minister's question time, we will see her do that in just a couple of days' time. Baroness Fall, when we look at what she has, when she has drifted into policy or what she might do, it's kind of got her in trouble, hasn't it? Her comments, for example, on maternity pay, she said it was excessive in that she felt, you know, it shouldn't, it's coming out of general taxation, you've got to have a look at that. And she suggested it had gone too far. Do you think that turned quite a few women off?
So, look, I think that sometimes Kemi shoots from the hip, and I think now she's a leader of the party, she needs to be more circumspect about what she says. It's also why people like her. They feel like she says the stuff that's on people's minds, and they find that quite refreshing. That particular point, I think, you know, wasn't the right thing to say, and I think, you know, would have lost her support. I think another thing for Kemi to think about is there's the role of leader of the opposition, and I worked for David Cameron when he was leader of the opposition. You know, you're taking the fight to Labour, but you're also trying to get cut through. Part of it is getting attention, but you don't want to find that you're the darling of SW1, but you don't, to Ella's point, really resonate and really talk about the issues that matter to people. And then the other thing, of course, is you've got to find a pathway back to power. Now, sometimes people are good leaders of the opposition, but they never take the party back to power. They never say to the people of the country, this is why conservative values and solutions are the right thing for the modern problems that we face.
Ella, what do you think about, I don't know whether you caught the first interview she gave with Laura Kunzberg yesterday, and she kind of very much played down this unique position she finds herself in to be the first black woman to lead a major political party in the UK. She also took a bit of a side swipe at Rachel Reeves, the fact that she was the first female chancellor ever in this country's history to deliver a budget. What did you make of that?
I wasn't surprised. I hosted an event with Kemi a couple of years ago, and we had lots of young women there and lots of young women of colour who were eager to ask her, you know, what's your advice as a young woman of colour? And Kemi was genuinely quite baffled. I mean, she genuinely didn't want to talk about it. She wanted to talk about policy. She said, oh, I'd much rather talk about housing or the economy. I mean, why do you want to talk about this? So I think she sees herself as an MP, is now the leader of the Conservative Party, and I think she finds identity politics, including her own identity, very dull. But that's not to say that representation isn't important. I mean, I think lots of women, you know, of all political stripes were very proud to see Rachel Reeves presenting a budget last week. I think it's important that little black girls will turn on the television and see someone that looks like them at the dispatch box and never have a feeling of, oh, people like who look like me don't belong in Westminster.
But is she also kind of diminishing their experience when she says, effectively, you know, whatever you're going through, it doesn't matter, just plow on? I mean, there is structural racism in society. Is she kind of shying away from those difficult conversations?
I don't think that's her intention at all, but I think she wants to be seen as the leader of the Conservative Party. And I think she takes very seriously what she says. She wants her policies and her work in the party to speak for themselves, as I think we all do. And I think whilst we're all proud of our various intersectional identities, you wish to be taken seriously as a broadcaster. Lawyers wish to be taken seriously as lawyers. And I think we can all empathise with that.
Final word to you then, Baroness Fall. What do you think? How she's saying, just take me as I am. I'm a black woman doing this job, but, you know, I'm doing the job. I don't want you to focus on any other kind of special characteristic about me. Do you think that's a policy that might stand her in good stead in the long run?
Look, I would go for both. It's an aspiration when she says, you know, we shouldn't be surprised by somebody who is a black woman being leader of the party. But the fact that she is makes it easier, to Ella's point, for other people to feel that they can follow her down that path. And I think that's a great tribute to her, to the party. And by the way, it was great to have a female chancellor. There was a time in government when I worried women are given, you know, we'll give them the social jobs and then the men do the fiscal policy. And it was really good to see that at first from Rachel Reeves.
Great to have you both on the programme. Thank you so much for joining us on Woman's Hour this morning. Baroness Kate Fall and Ella Robertson Mackay. Thank you both for joining us. Earlier we heard from Katie Balls as well. And some outlets are reporting the understand Kemi Badenoch has appointed a joint chair of the party. As I said, more details on that and other appointments, we will bring them to you live here on Woman's Hour, and they will come to you, of course, on the BBC News website as well. Now for my next guest, a lifetime of training and hard graft all came down to 10 seconds and 72 milliseconds, a sprint on a rainy Paris evening back in August. I'm talking about the fastest woman in the world, Julianne Alfred, the St. Lucia-born sprinter, bagged herself the gold in the women's 100 metres at this year's Olympics and got a silver in the 200 metres too. Her medals marked the first time St. Lucia won an Olympic medal of any colour. You may have seen videos of the eruptions of joy back home on the island at viewing parties. A national holiday in the country has been named Julianne Alfred Day. Julianne is over in the UK looking to inspire the next generation of young athletes. I'm delighted to say she joins me in the Woman's Hour studio. Welcome to Woman's Hour.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant to have you here. A few months on, is it sinking in yet? Do you wake up every day and think, I did do that?
Not quite, to be honest, but I do get reminded of it a lot. Just by how much St. Lucians have celebrated me since winning the gold in Paris. But I don't wake up every day thinking, oh, I'm the Olympic champion. No, but I do get reminded of it whenever St. Lucians get a chance to.
I'll bet. I mean, I watched it back recently and one commentator said post-race, she was out and it was over. It was over by the 50-metre mark. Did you think then it's mine to lose? Did you realise how much distance you had on the other competitors?
I didn't actually until I rewatched the video over and over again. But you know, it's a race plan that my coach and I have been working on. My coach Edric Florial back in Austin, Texas. We've been working on this race plan over and over and visualizing how we're going to execute this race, the Olympic final, and it just finally came into fruition and I did just that. But I didn't realize how far I was away from the rest of the field.
It's just an incredible race. It was pouring with rain. You're on the line. Take us back to that moment. You know, either side of you, some of the most high-profile sprinters the world has ever known.
Right.
What's going through your head?
After the semi-final, winning semi-final two, I realised I had such a great chance of getting the gold medal. And as I stood on the line, watching down the track alongside the other seven women, other seven finalists, I was just thinking of my race plan, executing and thinking of each phase that I had to go through to win the gold. And my biggest challenge was the blocks. You know, 2022, I had a false start World Championships. So I had to really pay attention to just the gun, do not anticipate it, and just work on just thinking of my execution. But it was a lot of pressure, I'm not going to lie. Standing there, knowing that my country, St. Lucia, an entire nation is watching, looking forward to a medal. I'm not sure if it was gold or whatever, but I just know that they were expecting a medal, their first ever. And I was just thinking of my execution and trying to deliver for them.
Tell us what you wrote in your journal the morning of the race.
One of the things that I wrote down is Julianne Alfred, Olympic champion, just manifesting, knowing how hard I've worked for this moment. Also, I wrote that the world will know my name. I am unstoppable. It's my race. My coach has prepared me for it. Have fun. There were so many different things that I wrote down, but just realizing that I had a great chance of winning and also believing in myself before going to the finals that I was already the Olympic champion.
Yeah, gosh, well, that manifestation worked. And then some. Let's talk about the celebrations when you cross the line. I mean, men have been known to rip off their shirts when they cross the line, jump around, beat their chest, you know, go up to the camera, right, you know, pointing and all of that. You screamed. You were clearly overcome with emotion. You're not a very flashy person,
no,
but that
not.
Gives you a great authenticity, I think, that you just go, all of those years just came out, didn't
they? Right. Oh, my God. It's been a long journey that not many persons know about. Whenever I get a chance to tell them about my story, I do, because it's been a long journey. You don't just get here just like that. You know, it's a build-up to it. Leaving my home at a young age of 14, going to Jamaica, training for 3 years there, then moving to Texas on my own, spending 5 years at the University of Texas in Austin to get into this point in my career. Lots of trials and tribulations that I've been through, lots of hardships, injuries that I have to battle. It's been a long journey. So when you finally cross the line and getting cold, the thing you've worked so hard for in your entire life, when it finally comes through and you cross the line first, it's such an amazing feeling. All I could scream was, yes, yes, yes. I mean, it wasn't so calm, but I was screaming at the top of my lungs. But honestly, it's such an amazing feeling just knowing that all your hard work and sacrifice is finally paid off. And it's what my coach and I have been working towards. And early on that season, well, this season, sorry, I had a breakdown. I was completely out of it. I told my coach I didn't want to continue the season. I told my agent to cancel my meets because I just didn't want to continue. I was just so hard on myself. I was overweight as well, struggling mentally and just feeling like I couldn't go on. But my coach, he worked with me. He took me off the track for a little bit. We had a long conversation. We both cried on the phone. And the last thing he said to me was, are you ready to be an Olympic champion? And he believed that I could be one. He worked with my agent as well to get me prepared, you know, mentally and physically, and have some meets in place so I can prepare for the Olympics.
Yeah, so, I mean, goodness, I mean, he stepped in at the right point, didn't he? He could see what was happening.
Yes.
I mean, to go back, for people who don't know your story, you know, you were running on grass in bare feet, because where you were in St. Lucia, there wasn't an athletic stadium for you to train on, was there?
No, there wasn't. Actually, our national stadium is all the way to the south of the island in Viewfort. But where I lived, the Castries, the capital of St. Lucia, we don't have a track there. So we have like little grass tracks that we paint around when it's time for school sports. So I trained on there and I joined the club at the age of 9. And, you know, just being so young, I didn't really have like much athleisure to wear and walk around in. And I didn't have the proper shoes until my coach, my childhood coach, Cuthbert Modest, he gave me my first pair of shoes, my first pair of trainers and spikes. Until then, I was just running around without any shoes. Sometimes I'll be training in my school shirt, my school uniform at times, because I just didn't have the proper attire to train at times.
So all of that stacked up against you, and then the tragic loss of your father when you were just 12 years old. And you talked about walking away maybe before the Olympics, but that was a pivotal point as well, when you thought, I'm not sure I can do this.
Yeah, no, that was such a hard time for me. At a young age, knowing my dad, and, you know, he also had his own struggles as well. So the last time I saw him was when he took me to training at the Mindo Philip Park. That was probably like a few weeks prior, and that was the last time I saw him. So it really hurt me that I didn't get a chance to say goodbye to him, or even just see him in his final days. And it really hurt me, and I was devastated. I was hurt. And it just took a toll on me to the point where I felt like I couldn't go on. And he really looked forward to me. He was always so boastful to others when he spoke about me and spoke highly of me. But, I mean, it tore me apart just seeing that my dad is no longer here with me.
You've had to come back from so much. You must have so much strength. And you talk about moving to Jamaica. And this is obviously one of your all-time heroes, Usain Bolt is from Jamaica. So I'm wondering how much strength or guidance that you got from people like him, maybe before you met him, but also in his attitude, in his approach, because he seems to take it all in his stride.
Right. I've listened to his story also on where he grew up in Jamaica, just seeing how great of an athlete he is. And, you know, everything is a process. He didn't just get to be the fastest man in the world. It took him some time. He had some losses as well. And just taking a page out of his book and using it in my own life to get to where I want to go.
Yeah. Well, he's a certain inspiration, isn't he, really?
Yeah.
And he won some of his, I mean, you won in the pouring rain, and some of his greatest achievements were in the pouring rain as well. That must have inspired you.
Oh, my God. The morning of the Olympic final, I watched some of his races, and just, I went back to my inner child, just remembered how I looked up to him as a young child. And I watched his races and put myself in that same position and saying, I want to be just like Usain Bolt. I actually said I want to be the female Usain Bolt, but it's kind of cringe saying it now. But just looking at him, and I took myself back to that younger Julian looking up to Usain Bolt, and just pictured myself crossing the line first and being just like him. And I just wanted to put that into the Olympic final as well.
I think he wants to be just like you now. You're the more recent. Oh, you're God. The more recent winner. Let's talk about what you're doing here in the UK, and you know, using your position as Olympic 100 meter champion to inspire the next generation. What are you doing?
So right now I'm here for the World Travel Market with St. Lucia, promoting our island's beauty, the warmth of our people, and allowing people to know what St. Lucia is like. Mm. Such a tiny island that not many persons know about, but also using my platform and using my voice to talk about and promote my country.
And your Prime Minister says you're going to have a day named after you. How does that feel?
It's an amazing feeling. One that I didn't expect, especially after winning an Olympic medal. Like I said, they could have given me the smallest thing, and I'll just be so appreciative of just how much love and support that they've showed me since winning. And a day named after me, it means a lot to me.
And do you want a new stadium? I mean, I know that's a big passion of yours as well, to actually use this opportunity to get people to invest in facilities back home.
Yeah, we don't have that many, to be quite honest. We have a national stadium that needs to be renewed. And we also have a mini stadium that we use now for small track meets. But I think because of the state of our stadium back in St. Lucia, we don't have as many big track meets as we should, especially when it comes to inter-secondary school or island champs. I think when our new stadium gets built, I mean, the youth will be excited to race on it. They'll look forward to it. I'm sure it'll allow them to stay on the track more. So I'm just looking forward for the government of St. Lucia, the Ministry of Sports, to just rebuild that stadium so track and field can be even bigger in St. Lucia.
We need the new Julian Alfred, don't we?
Yeah.
And just a little insight, when you're back home now, you said St. Lucians have gone absolutely crazy for you and what you've done for the country. I mean, how long does it take you to go to the shop these days?
I don't go to the shops, that's what it is. So I stay at a hotel when I went to St. Lucia. I usually make the sacrifice to just stay in Texas and train, so I don't really get distracted by what's happening around me. But when I do get a chance, I do have to, you know, watch where I go, because it can, you know, some missions are excited to just celebrate me, to see me. And like I said, I've just felt the love and support from them. So it's always an awesome feeling going back to St. Lucia and being on Stomping Grounds.
Oh, it's been fantastic having you in the studio.
Thank you so much
for joining us. Julian Alfred there. She is currently the fastest woman in the world. Complete honour to have you in the Woman's Hour studio. Thank you so much for joining us. You are listening to Woman's Hour, and we're going to talk to an author next. Her books have been described as pitch black comedy, show-stopping and visceral. Her first book, Boy Parts, was made Blackwell's Fiction Book of the Year in 2022, and she was named in the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. Now the author, Eliza Clark, has a brand new collection of short stories out entitled She's Always Hungry, and Eliza joins me now. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
It's great to have you here. This is your third book to be published,
yes.
Your first short story collection, She's Always Hungry. Hungry, an intriguing title. Tell us more.
This had kind of always been the title of the collection. I'd gotten quite lucky with the title of my first book. With my second book, Penance, I was a bit more, it took me ages to decide on something. But She's Always Hungry was always the title. It's the title of the title story in the collection. I'm saying the word title a lot.
That's right. I get that. So what is it? What is the theme that you thought, yes, this will hang all these stories together?
You know, it's funny because the collection has sort of, I guess, been collected rather than written in one go, over the course of about 6 or 7 years. So, I was quite lucky that my interests are quite narrow as a writer. So, desire and hunger are the core themes. And I was just quite lucky that was applicable in to some extent to all of the stories in the collection.
And what then? Because I'm looking at the themes and, it's an intriguing read. It really is.
Thank you.
Of body image and beauty. There's a couple of stories that focus on what we as women do to ourselves to be skinny, violence against women and girls, as well. There's a story, the She's Always Hungry story, subverting the patriarchy. Men are the lower beings, daughters the prized over sons. Is it gender that interests you or the power that lies behind it?
Yeah, I think I'm primarily interested in power and power structures and the way those power structures often manifest themselves as interpersonal violence. So for me, gender is a way to talk about power, and quite an easy way to talk about power, I think. It's a good shortcut to have.
Yeah. And so what is your view then? How old are you now?
I'm 30.
Just 30. So on the nose. I mean, you're living in a society where you still feel the injustice of that, do you?
I think so. I feel it's interesting the sort of political moment that we're living in, because I feel like women have made a lot of gains in the last, particularly since I was a teenager. You know, I kind of was a child in the 2000s when I remember there was, it felt like the 2000s was a period of a bit of a backlash to progress that had been made in the 80s and 90s, and the 2000s felt like quite a sort of, you know, it was kind of heroin chic and low-rider jeans and a news media that was constantly extremely cruel to young women who were in the public eye. And I think that was sort of living through that was quite a big feminist awakening for me in some ways. I particularly remember the media treatment of Courtney Stodden, who was famously married to a much, much older actor when she was about 16 or 17. And I remember being very shocked when I found out that Courtney Stodden was actually about a month younger than me, and being very kind of taken aback by that. So it's something that, you know, I've having lived through the 2000s, it's something that I've always kind of carried with me, is that early, that period of backlash. And it's interesting that I feel like we're in another period of a bit of a backlash again.
Tell me more about that then. Yeah. Why do you think we're living through that period as a 30-year-old woman?
Yes, I feel like, again, because there are quite a lot of gains made in the last sort of 10, 15 years or so, I feel like there's been a big pushback socially to that. I think you can kind of see that in the way that incel culture has kind of arisen over the last few years. I think you can see it now in the United States with the attack on women's health and women's access to healthcare. And I think you can see that somewhat trickling over to the UK as well.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting. We were just talking about the new leader of the Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch, who's saying, you know, don't make a big deal out of the fact that I'm the first black woman to head up this party. And lots of people would say, well, good on her, because, you know, just get on, get your nose down and do the job. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, in some ways, I do sort of think it's fair enough that, you know, as a professional woman, you don't necessarily want the only thing people to talk about to be your gender, and in Kemi's case as well, her racial identity. I do, however, you know, I think it's a little bit rich to say that while you're also kind of campaigning about how you're going to take away maternity pay, or you're going to, you know, generally kind of make things a bit more difficult for people like you.
Well, she would qualify that if she was here. She was saying that the burden on the general taxpayer is too much. But you're right, she did get herself in hot water over that. Now, let's go back to the book. That's what we're here to talk about. I digressed. There's a content warning at the start of the book, with more details on potentially triggering subjects at the back of the book. Mm-hmm. Now, why was it important for you to do that? Of course, you didn't want to give away any spoilers,
yes,
which is why there's more detail at the back of the book.
Yes.
But why do that?
I think content guides are a good thing to have in books, purely just because, you know, I'm a big film fan. I'm very interested in the film censors in the UK. I, you know, periodically make use of a BBFC report, just because I'm quite interested in film classification, which makes me sound very dull, and that's because I am. I actually feel like we could benefit in some ways from bringing in some kind of, not necessarily a formal classification system, but just a sort of BBFC style report for books. I think a lot of people would find that really useful, because it's one of the only pieces of media where, you know, we don't have anything like that. And I think to an extent it's because you can stop reading in the middle of a sentence. You can't kind of unsee an image once you've seen it. But I actually think that we could, you know, really like empower readers to look after themselves and be able to take personal responsibility by adding in things like content guides.
Yes, because there's nothing. You go into a bookshop and it's just subject led, isn't it? Or age led, but nothing else. I can hear the people already saying, well, that's kind of a bit nanny state, isn't it? People should be able to walk in and make up their own minds. How do you think it would help the reader?
Yeah, I suppose it's, I would respond that it just allows people to make up their own minds. I think as well, it means from an author's perspective, you can have people having quite visceral and quite hostile reactions to the content of your books. And, you know, as an author, in some ways, you kind of don't really have a leg to stand on of like, well, why did you read it when I'd made it quite clear that this content was going to be in it? And you can't really say that right now, but I can for She's Always Hungry.
You can now. Let's talk then about young female authors. You've spoken about it being a very tough terrain for women like you. Why?
I think, again, I suppose we're living in a little bit of a backlash. I think we're at a period where for the first time, most of our sort of big young writers are women. And I think people, you know, over the course of the kind of 5 to 10 years that's happened, it does seem like people have perhaps forgotten about the last 1,000 years or so of literature where men were very much kind of dominating the scene. And I think that it's just very easy to be kind of sniffy and chippy about young women's writing, particularly when their audience is young women as well. But that does just reflect who's reading books, really. So it does mean that you can just end up with some quite dismissive, I would say, responses to your work.
Yeah. Who have you had that? Clearly you must have done.
Yes.
Right, okay. And you think that might be different if you were a young male author?
Maybe. I feel like potentially I might be being dismissed in different ways. It's interesting because there are so few young male authors at the minute. And that I would be, like, I always kind of flag my concern that we'll lose marginalised men's voices in this kind of influx of young women authors. Like, I think it would be terrible if we kind of lost the very few books that are being published by black men, that are being published by queer men.
Is there always a comparison? For example, if you're a young female author, you may at the moment get compared to Sally Rooney. Do you think that's the thing? When you have certain women who are breakouts and really kind of leading the pack, that you've kind of got a dovetail in behind them?
Yes, basically. I feel like if you publish a book right now, you're only going to be either favourably or unfavourably compared to Sally Rooney, even if your writing has absolutely nothing to do with hers. And, you know, Sally Rooney's a fantastic writer, but it just because she's also a woman in her early 30s, it doesn't mean that all of us are kind of attempting to or writing in some kind of Sally Rooney-esque vein. And I think it can be quite exhausting both for, you know, the women novelists who are doing something quite different. And I imagine for Sally Rooney herself.
Yes, she can't be all things to all women. And it's dark and it's comic. It's comic and there's a horror element to your writing as well. It kind of had a bit of a Tales of the Unexpected vibe, certain short stories that I was reading. What attracts you to that genre?
Gosh, I think I'm just quite morbid. I've always liked horror. It's one of my favourite genres. I've always been very, very influenced by it. I think I'm always interested in what, as a film critic, whose first name is Linda, and I always forget her second name, who talks about the body genres, the idea of, you know, horror, melodrama and erotica as being the kind of genres that induce like a physical reaction in the person watching a film or reading a book. And I think that's sort of primarily what I'm interested in as well, is this sort of quite visceral and intense feeling that you can get from reading and watching films and television and so on.
And do you think thematically you can claim that back because you're writing about it from a female perspective? Because very often that hasn't historically happened in that genre, has it? Yeah. And the women have been objectified, and one could argue that they often are in modern crime thrillers as well.
Yeah, I think so. I'm often quite forgiving about older horror fiction. I think often, particularly in films, there are quite some quite interesting like proto-feminist readings you can get from horror that could also be classed as sexist. I suppose it's one of the things that I find interesting about the genre as well, is that it is so divisive, and that it, you can get all of these different kind of things out of it depending on who you are.
Well, listen, I know you've got some exciting potential film projects in the offing. Can you talk about those?
I actually can't. Okay. I'm doing the adaptation of my first novel, Boy Parts, but I can't really say much beyond that.
Well, listen, it's been a joy to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us. The short story collection, She's Always Hungry by Natalie Hewitt, is out on Thursday this week. As always, if you've been affected by anything, why did I call you? I called you Natalie Hewitt. That's our next guest.
Yes.
I'm getting ahead of myself. Eliza, I do apologise. Okay. Eliza Clark is out on Thursday this week. As always, if you have been affected by anything in that conversation, help and resources are available on the BBC Action Line website. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, we are going to talk to Natalie Hewitt. Natalie, your eyes popped open there. I didn't realise I'd written a collection of short stories. Natalie Hewitt, my next guest, spent 2 months in Antarctica directing and producing on the documentary film Endurance, which is about Ernest Shackleton's 1914 expedition, in which his crew had to abandon ship in pack ice and survive for over a year before they were rescued. The documentary features restored footage and, quite brilliantly, AI recreated voices of the original crew, as well as the moment of discovery in March 2022 of Shackleton's ship 3,000 metres down in the icy waters of the Weddell Sea. Natalie joins me in the studio now. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's an incredible watch. You went to the coldest place on Earth to film this search for Shackleton's ship. And I understand part of the motivation is because as a woman in the film industry, you were finding it hard to get a break, weren't you?
Well, that was my first trip to Antarctica. So my first film that I directed actually was in Antarctica, but it was back in 2016. And I had been producing for quite a long time, and I got this voicemail from an old boss of mine who said, would you like to go to Antarctica on your own for 3 months to make a film for the BBC? I need to know by tomorrow lunchtime. And I sort of, like, the kind of background context of that was I just finished a project with Dan Snow and some other incredible filmmakers where we'd been on this expedition in the Yukon for the BBC. And in the evenings, we'd sit around the campfire, and two of our guides on that trip were polar explorers, and they would tell these stories of their trips to Antarctica. And I was sitting there secretly thinking to myself, well, that sounds horrendous. Why would you ever want to go there? It's kind of like freezing cold, always windy, snow blowing in your eyes. And there was a story about a poo freezing in a toilet, which I just thought, I was just like, no, why would you ever want to go there? And then obviously, like, 2 months later, I got this phone call saying, do you want to go? And there were two things about that call which I sort of realised. One was, I was like, I think this is my chance. I think this is my break. It's so hard, I think, for women in the film industry to move from producing into directing. I think there's, you know, there's still loads and loads of problems, and you see it borne out in the statistics. You know, we still have 75% of factual television in the UK is directed by men, despite sort of equal numbers of, you know, equal people from each gender going into the film industry. And so I kind of thought, well, this is my chance. But I also had this sort of thing in the back of my mind where I was like, I just really want to know why people go there. Like, why, what makes someone want to go to this place, which sounds so awful and difficult to be.
So you've been twice now. So paint a picture for us and our listeners, if you will, of what it's like, to survive there. What does it do physically to you and to your equipment?
I mean, it's quite an overwhelming experience in lots of ways. Certainly when you first arrive, I remember the first time I went to Antarctica, and as the plane landed, I thought to myself, oh my goodness, what have I done? Because they say to you in your kind of pre-deployment training, so it's easier to get back from the International Space Station than it is to get back from Antarctica in the winter. And they're very, very clear to you that, like, if anything happens to your family, if anything happens at home, you are not going home until your plane ticket, which for me was 3 months later. So it's very overwhelming, the isolation and the sort of desolation of it. You know, I think on that first trip, I remember about 2 weeks in seeing a bird fly across the sky and being just taken aback by it, because I was so used to this completely flat horizon in every direction forever and ever and ever. And in that sense, it's very difficult. You know, obviously, there's so much kind of that you have to think about in terms of your own safety and the safety of your crew. You know, the first time I was there on my own, but for Endurance, I had an amazing film crew with me. And actually, one morning on the Endurance shoot, I came down. I think it was about sort of 6 o'clock in the morning, and I came down to the back deck, and one of my amazing cinematographers called James had been filming all night, and they just, I think, launched the underwater drone and put it in the sea. And I came out and I was like, you know, asking what was going on. And he just turned around and looked at me, and all of his eyelashes had frozen. And I was like, James, I think you probably need to go inside and get warm, because I don't think we can allow anything else on you to freeze. Like, we just need to. So it is, but it is one of those things also where it's very surreal, because after you've been there for a while, it becomes very normal. You know, it becomes very normal to have to wear incredible amounts of clothes to go outside. It becomes very normal to have to put like lots of layers of gloves on to go and do things. And I remember on my first trip, it kind of became normal to go to breakfast on a skidoo. And, yeah. And then you're kind of like, is this, I remember getting back from my first trip and thinking, have I filmed anything interesting? Because it all became so normal to me to go to breakfast on a skidoo, or to go and film the penguins, or, you know. And actually, thankfully, when I got home and started working with my editor and my exec producers, and they were like, no, this is very odd and unusual, and this is very interesting.
Well, you certainly did film some very fascinating stuff. And the moment when the wreck is discovered is quite a point in that film. Talk us through it. I mean, this is the life's work for people on that ship, one in particular who'd made an aborted attempt before. What was it like to be there when they discovered it?
Yeah, I mean, the honest answer is quite stressful. And also, I just, the emotion that I felt was just relief. Because, you know, for those who haven't seen the film, there was a bit of a blip, shall we say, in the search. I don't want to give too much away, which had happened a couple of weeks earlier. And obviously there was the failed expedition, or the failed attempt in 2019. And then also we had got to the point where we were on the clock. We know we potentially had to leave at any moment. You know, we had technically kind of 2 or 3 days left on the charter of the ship, but actually we'd got to the stage where we were checking in with the captain kind of every couple of hours, because the worry was that the weather would change. And if it got really cold, we could get frozen in just like Shackleton did, and obviously no one wanted that. So we really were aware, like keenly aware at that point, that time was running out and we had very little opportunity left. And so actually that moment was both kind of relief and also quite stressful, because I knew we had a matter of days to film all of the kind of unraveling and impact of that, you know, just to see how that affected the crew and how they would then go and film it and do these incredible 3D scans. You know, that was all still to come. And I knew it was really important to document that, because it was a world first, you know, to scan a shipwreck to 1 millimeter resolution in 3D at 3,000 meters below the surface of the sea. It had never been done before. And I knew there were lots of challenges still to come. So it was busy.
It was exactly. You're not there as a fan. You're there working. It is incredible. And we have to talk about the man himself, Shackleton's story. It can be seen as a triumph of spirit, but also one of, you could say, male ego, entitlement. As it points out in the documentary, he kept going back to Antarctica because his whole status was based on these expeditions. Ultimately, he failed in his goal. He risked many lives in the process. He did save many lives in the process as well. He never left a man behind. How do you view him now?
I mean, I'm fascinated by Shackleton. I think he is such an interesting character. And I also think the way that we, you know, have culturally understood him or lauded him has been very interesting to see as well. You know, obviously for this film, I did months and months and months and months and months of research, you know, reading everything I could possibly find, watching everything I could possibly find, listening to everything I could possibly find, and really trying to get an understanding of him as a man. And I suppose the two things that I've come away with, which I feel are just so powerful, and I hope, you know, people kind of see unfolding in the film, are that Shackleton was a man who, you know, his greatest success actually came out of his greatest failure. And so, you know, I think also as a woman in the exploration space and in the filmmaking space, you know, I think there's so much, especially in exploration film and storytelling, you know, there is a lot of bravado, as you said, and there is a kind of, you know, male hero character or sort of preconception of what a male hero should be. And that's why one of the reasons I love Shackleton, because I think that he actually shows the value of failure when we're trying to do great things and when we're trying to do new things and when we're trying to push boundaries. And the fact that he, you know, yeah, had this incredible achievement from failure and had the both the humility and the foresight and the kind of attitude to be able to learn from that and grow from that, I think is amazing.
Watching the documentary, there don't seem to be many women in the expedition crew. I think there was one French woman I clocked for the whole. I mean, there's clearly a long way to go on that side of things too.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about this work, because I think, you know, there is still a huge disparity in sort of the representation of people and backgrounds within the exploration world. And I think, you know, for me, I feel if whilst there are still aren't enough women in that world, at least I can bring a female voice to it. And I think, you know, for so long, the stories have been about men and told by men. And I think that's why, you know, even though this story, you know, Shackleton's story is still very much about men, but at least it has female voices bringing that kind of new perspective to it. And yes, we, you know, on the exhibition, actually, I was really pleasantly surprised about the amount of women that were on the crew of the ship. So that the ship, the incredible S.A. Agulhas II, is a South African ship. And actually, I was really impressed that there were quite a number of female crew members running the ship. And then on our expedition crew, I think we had about 7 or 8. So obviously, see Maver, and she is the only woman on the subsea team, who were the team who did the actual kind of operating of the underwater vehicle. But we had a bunch of female scientists with us. Obviously, I was there. We had a female photographer with us. And, you know, there it was a pleasant surprise that, you know, because sometimes I am the only woman, like, on a film shoot.
Just, if you can tell me very briefly, what's that like?
It's both fine and sort of surreal. Like, it's one of those things where I'm like, I just, you know, we're all humans. And I think when I'm at work, I'm just like, we're all humans and we are all here to do a job. And I sort of try not to think about those things. But I think sometimes you do notice it. Sometimes the way that people maybe approach, or the expectations, I suppose, you know, I've had a number of like emails where it's like, oh, we want you to come and direct on this, but we need you to know that the cameras are very heavy. Will you be okay with that?
Yeah, I'm fine with that. Natalie, great to talk to you. Natalie Hewitt and Endurance is streaming on Disney Plus now. Join me tomorrow on Woman's Hour. If you've ever received a correspondent that began, Dear Sirs, one Woman's Hour listener is trying to do away with that. And Susie Dent will join us too to talk that through. Woman's Hour tomorrow from 10.
That's all from today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Young, and I'm happy to tell you that Young Again, my podcast for BBC Radio 4, is back with more conversations with people who fascinate me. In the new series, we'll hear from the comedian Miranda Hart.
Part of being human is that we are vulnerable.
The writer Irvine Welsh.
It's quite a thing to be 8 years old and then suddenly to have a criminal record.
And we'll begin with a conversation with the actor Minnie Driver.
What do you wish you'd understood about the movie business?
It's all ephemera. None of it is real.
Subscribe to Young Again on BBC Sounds.